Good morning and welcome. My name is Brian Field, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Warren Rees. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region, serving as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The talk will be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. The speaker has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in any of the glass donation bowls. Thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is Dr. Warren Rees, Associate Professor of History at the University of Maine's Darling Center. I met Warren when I was a graduate student there in the mid-1970s. Since then, Warren earned his doctorate in maritime history from the University of New Hampshire. He has published numerous papers on American maritime history and published two books, Angel Gabriel, The Elusive English Galleon, and The Ship That Held Up Wall Street. Earlier in his career, he was a curator at the Mariners Museum, a consulting curator for the Peabody Museum, and the Smithsonian Institution, as well as consulting editor for National Geographic magazine. He currently serves as president of the North American Society of Oceanic History. Just last week, Warren was awarded the John Gardner Award for significant contributions to maritime history by the Mystic Seaport Museum. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce my friend, Dr. Warren Rees.
Thank you, Brian. Are we on? Yeah. Okay, thank you, Brian. And thank you for having me here. It's quite an honor. I've heard of the Monadnock Lyceum for quite a while. To be here speaking to you feels pretty good. This is a different subject. There's a different kind of project than I've normally worked on in my life. Most of my research has been either in the archives or underwater, working on shipwrecks underwater. But what I'm going to talk to you about today is a project where we excavated a ship on land and spent some 30 years trying to figure it all out, analyzing and interpreting it. Underwater, it's a different world. We're weightless, which is great in archaeology because you can float over your site and not disturb it if you're careful. On the other hand, I made the stupid decision early in life to focus on colonial New England ships and merchant trade, which means you're in the cold water and it's dark and gloomy down there and the mud and everything. If I had been smarter, I would have focused maybe on the Caribbean or the Aegean, where I got some of my training. On the other hand, on land, you have the ability to be on your site all day long as the director or whoever you are on the site. So there are a lot of benefits for both, and this was quite interesting. Now, let me backtrack a little. One of the questions I often get is, why would someone spend their life studying old ships and merchant trade in the ocean or under the streets of New York? Well, I started off in science. I was a science nerd, and then I was a physics major for the first 2.5 years of college, took some ocean engineering courses, and then got smart and decided what I wanted to do in life. I studied with George Bass, who some of you, if you're into this subject, would know. He's the father of nautical archaeology. Worked with him in 1969. And then eventually I just got interested more in the colonial period in the British Empire. So this 17th, 18th century, focused on the merchant trade of the colonial empire. So what I want to talk to you today is about a project that was for a long time called the Ronson Ship. Basically, in 1982, a ship was discovered in New York. And I'm going to cover the discovery, the excavation, the preservation, my interpretation and analysis of the site, and why I came to some of these conclusions. In New York, we have the Hudson River and Manhattan Island, which sits at the mouth of the Hudson. And in the early 1600s, the Dutch were exploring up through there, and they said, huh, we could really make this place work for us. We have Amsterdam in Europe. It's the economic center of the Western world. If you want big-time insurance, if you want to do some serious international banking, if you want to raise money for a merchant expedition, you went to Amsterdam in the early 1600s for that. So they thought, well, if we set up on this little island, we can control the whole hinterland of the Hudson and all the fur trading, and maybe we'll get some settlers there. And we're going to start a mini Amsterdam. They called it New Amsterdam. It's going to be the trading post of the New World. And that's what Manhattan started as. So in the 1650s, on the northern border of their settlement, they built a wall. They had a street along there called Wall Street. And that was the northern boundary. But the problem they had with the geography there, there was plenty of food. There was fish and everything was there for them. The furs were coming down the river, but they had a hard time unloading their ships and loading them up again because of there was shallow water all around Manhattan and mud flats. And so they started filling with rocks, and they typically took logs and made cribbing, like a little log house, if you will, and then filled it with rocks and soil and built out toward the deep water. So eventually they could bring their ships right along the quay and unload them instead of putting them into little flat boats and running them back and forth. Okay? So they started filling out. Well, in the 1660s, the English showed up with some ships, pointed their cannon and said, guess what? Drop your flag, you're now English. And they said, no problem. Can we stay here? And they said, oh yeah, you've got a good thing going. If you don't mind our flag being up, you all can stay. And that's why you get a lot of Dutch names. Manhattan today. So the English just continued doing the same thing, and they continued filling out over the mudflats and the shallow water as they expanded the city, or actually the little town, of New York. They changed the name. In so doing, every once in a while, they'd have an old ship. And they didn't know what to kind of do with this old ship. It was just some timbers rotting away. So they'd pay a couple of pounds for the hull, bring it into the shallow water, and instead of going through the trouble of getting the logs in there and making the cribbing, they just used an old ship, filled it with rocks and dirt and stuff, and became part of the fill. Eventually, they filled up over that. And so eventually, around New York, on those outer three blocks, all around the southern island on both sides, on the Hudson and on the East River, that's all fill. And there are a number of ships that are buried in that fill. Now, when they were doing construction early on, meaning up until the 1970s, when they found one of these ships, they just went right through it with the machines. When they built the telephone building in the 1960s along the East River, they went through four of those ships in one night with their equipment. Nobody even took photographs. But in the 1970s, the laws in New York changed. The people in New York said, that's enough. You got to do historic studies, you have to have archaeologists come in whenever there's anything in these historic districts. And so the archaeology has increased quite a bit. There have been four ships that we've had a chance to look at, and I'll go through them quickly so that you don't get mixed up which one I'm talking about. In 1916, they were building a subway just north of where the World Trade Center is, and they ran into about 18 feet of timber from an old ship. Now, it was in an area where the Dutch had lost the ship Tiger. It had caught fire, and they'd left the remnants there. So they assumed that was the remnants of Tiger. And for decades in the museum, that's what it was labeled as. But recently, some experts have been in there and said, no, this is not Dutch. This is an American colonial vessel from somewhere in the 18th century. Okay, so that's Tiger. We have about 18 feet of small vessel there. Then in 1978, they were doing some plumbing or something underneath one of the buildings of South Street Seaport Museum. So it's the other side, on the eastern side of Manhattan, but almost right across from the World Trade Center, just south of the Brooklyn Bridge. They were doing some plumbing and they run into a vessel. So the building was built right on top of a ship. And of course, they didn't want to tear their building down. So they just had a land archaeologist who didn't know ships go in and do some quick recording. So we got a little bit, you know, some photographs and some measurements of that. And it seems to be an top of an 18th century merchant ship. That's all we know. I'm going to jump ahead chronologically to 2010. Just a few years ago, they were excavating where they're going to put the new entrance into the new World Trade Center, and they ran into some ship timbers. And I was offered to go down there and be the principal investigator for that. So I went down there, and my wife Kathleen, and we had a local crew there, and we excavated that. And it seems to be a late 18th century vessel built right before the Revolution, flat bottom, very large sloop, merchant sloop. And interestingly enough, it had shipworms in it from the West Indies. So it had been doing some coastal trade. That's about all I can tell you now. It's being preserved. It'll end up in the State Museum of New York in Albany eventually. One of those things that just sort of fell into our laps when we were too busy. The agreement was we'll go in there, we'll do everything right, and then while it's being preserved, in a few years we'll get back to doing the research that we'll start on that later this year. Well, the fourth vessel is the one I'm going to be talking about today, right? 1982. Just south of South Street Seaport Museum on the eastern side, just north of Wall Street, well within the financial district there, a fellow named Ronson bought the city block for 175 Water Street and was going to put up a 30-story office building. He was required to have archaeologists go in there and check it out. And they were busy there for a few months excavating the buildings, the old buildings that were there, privies and backyards, and doing a nice study, and they found a ship. And so got a call. Shelley Smith and I co-directed the excavation of that. Now, the interesting thing was I was a graduate student at the time. I was finishing up my studies just before I was going to start into a dissertation topic. And I had just spent a semester studying the development of the British Empire from a maritime point of view. That was my whole study for the semester. And one of the things that fascinated me was that the British Empire in the first part of the 18th century, 1710 or so, was basically a very secondary colonial power. Some would say tertiary, compared to France and Spain and Portugal. It wasn't really that much at that point. We're just really getting going. The colonies here were very tiny. You know, New York was 7,000 people at most. Charleston was 7,000 people. The little towns, and those are the big places. So, but by the end of that century, it's the largest empire the world has ever known. How'd that happen? And it really happened between the War of Spanish Succession, Queen Anne's War, which ended in 1713, and the beginning of what we call the French and Indian War, the 1750s, during that time period, they were able to drop the cost of moving goods by 50%, moving goods across the ocean. And you think about that, that's pretty important when you're trying to develop an empire. My metaphor is think of an adolescent's body. And if you can increase the efficiency of the red blood cells in that adolescent's body, compared to the other person next to them, who's going to grow more efficiently, who's going to grow faster? Well, you know, if you can get all these things moving, the merchant ships and the merchant trade was what built that empire. Yeah, the Navy had to be there to protect it, for sure. So how'd they do that? And some economic historians in the 60s and 70s were trying to figure that out, and they said, well, you know, let's look at some factors. And the English had wiped out piracy everywhere they had their colonies. That was part of their policy. First thing you do is you kill off all the pirates. And then they built up their warehousing, and there were a few other factors, but they didn't all add up. And even synergistically, these factors didn't add up. And finally, Ralph Davis, one of the historians, said, you know, the only thing left that we don't know about is the ships, because there are no records. We don't know about the merchant ships. Maybe they made them more efficiently. And everybody scratched their head and said, well, you're just going to have to wait till somebody finds one. So I had finished that report, handed it in to my professor, and I got an A in that, by the way. And a month later, I was called down to New York to look at the remnants to say, is this a significant vessel? And I looked at it, and I was looking at a little gun port that they had found, a little tiny one, which would mean, and from the size of the ship and the small gun port, this is a merchant ship, an armed merchant ship, it wasn't a warship. And I could tell from various clues that this was early to mid 18th century British merchant ship, and I couldn't believe it. This was the answer to this report I just handed in, and nobody had seen one of these things. And there I was offered the ability to be the co-director of this. And so they asked me, how significant is this? Should we excavate this or blow it up? You know, and I gave them the two-hour version of what I just told you. So they said, okay, how long will it take you to do it? And this is mid-January. All the archaeologists had to be out of that block in 2 weeks. And I said, give me a week to give it up. So we've got to get going, take a look at what's left. And what was left was about 18 vertical feet and the whole length of the ship. The port side, the left side, was in the block. The starboard side, the right side, was under the street. We weren't going to get to it. So I said, I gave them a little spiel at a meeting, and I told them, you know, is it possible for us to get the month of February? I have a plan for us to excavate the whole thing and record it all in the month of February. We're talking winter in New York. I kind of held my breath, and they said, yeah, you can have February. Now, I knew that it was going to cost them $10,000 a day not to get started in February. But on March 1st, it was going to cost them $50,000 a day not to start, just because of their contracts. So that's why I asked for just February. They said, you got February. You said you needed 38, whatever my number was, archaeologists, and you need 3 pumps to keep the water level down. But we don't want any excuses on March 1st. So we want you to rent 5 pumps and hire a union pump operator. And we want to see 40-some archaeologists. Guy said, I want to see 5 archaeologists holding up shovels at all times, because I'd rather pay for a few extra people than for you to say, I need another day. So this was really strange. He said, you have no budget. You just spend what you need and get out of here. Do a perfect job. We don't want any trouble from the city or the state. You do a perfect job, not just what's needed. And, you know, think of it. I was a graduate student, and all my experience had been, we have no money, but we have plenty of time. So off we went. We had one day of sunshine in February. It snowed on us. We had snowstorms. We had freezing rainstorms. It was one of, and I'm living in Maine, you know, so this was pretty nasty stuff down in the pit. And we were up to our ankles or knees in mud all the time if it wasn't frozen. The water would come in every night. On purpose, we'd let the water table come in to keep the wood from freezing, because it would be destroyed. It's so fragile. And then in the morning, I had a team show up at 6 in the morning every morning and pump it out. And then we'd excavate down. And we excavated down about 18 feet to the bottom of this hull, all by hand, with shovels and trowels. We didn't use brushes because it was muddy. You just used a hose when you had to. Thousands of artifacts. And basically what we had was a ship, and it had obviously been stripped down, everything taken out of it. It had been brought into shallow water, and it was spiked to some pilings there. So it was obviously brought in as far as they could get it and spiked to some pilings. It was filled mostly with ballast from other ships. This is excess weight that the other ships had come into. Remember from 8th grade American history, we're bringing in manufactured goods from Europe and shipping out raw material. Well, the manufactured goods, you got to keep the value similar, so the manufactured goods didn't take up much weight. So all the ships coming into New York had extra ballast. And what do you do with it? You don't drop it in the middle of the harbor, you fill up the deep water. So they put it into these fill areas. And we had mounds of coral from the West Indies, brain coral and other types of coral sand. We had volcanic sand, black sand. We had beach rock from England. It's rather interesting. So we finished up, and I'm a contingency planner, and we had contingency plans for various things that might go wrong or might go right. And one of them was, what if they let us save the bow? Wouldn't that be cool? This is such a neat bow. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. If you're really into ship design. Come see me afterwards. I'll give you more details. And so out of the blue, a week before we were to finish, the city of New York asked us to save the bow. Well, one would think, if you hadn't done this before, that you just chop off the bow and you have a big crane pick it up and move it. But actually, that's more time-consuming and more expensive and worse from a research point of view than to take it apart piece by piece. Because you can get a small crew in there just wedging those pieces off after they've been recorded, and a backhoe acting as a crane, just piece after piece coming out. And then you get to study all the different facets of each piece of wood, which otherwise would be all locked together. And then preserving it later, it works better because you can clean it all and the chemicals get to it. So we did that. But one of the things you have to realize through this whole thing is that archaeology is a different kind of science. As I said, I started in physics. So if I were a physicist and I did an experiment and I messed it up, I could do it again tomorrow after I get enough money to get the Hubble telescope to move the right way when I wanted it to. Chemistry, biology, I can go out, take another sample, or I could do it perfectly and not publish it, and that's too bad, but somebody else could do the experiment again. In archaeology, you get one shot. We destroy each layer as we go down. So not only do we have to record everything, and as I tell my students, if you do not do everything right, and if you do not publish that, you don't get to see St. Peter when you die, you go straight to hell. It's not a publish or perish, it's a very strict ethical situation. And so we have to be very, very careful about it. And part of that too is asking the right question. Because it's one thing to say, oh, you've got to record this, okay? These things here on the podium, the light and the two microphones. But it's another thing to know what questions might be asked of that information in the future or today by various people who are studying various things, in this case, electronics versus design, and what questions. So therefore, what are we recording here? And so in this case, I didn't have much time to go out and do my homework to ask various historians and archaeologists, what would you like to know? But we did the best we could with the phones and things. We finished our excavation. And in our recording, we recorded by mapping, filling out forms and design and saving artifacts, writing notes. Each little team within the site had their own notebooks, their waterproof notebooks. We were used to working underwater or out off islands and stuff. So we typically used all waterproof everything, and then which served us right in that weather. And then it's 1982. So at the end of the summer, we'd get off our boat normally and copy everything. It didn't occur to us, we're in the middle of New York City, we could have copied everything at the end of every day. They did have photocopiers in those days. And so we didn't do that. And we went home the last weekend to just sort of get all the mud and dirt out. And then we came back to New York on Monday. I had brought my notebook, which was sort of the director's overall thing. You see it in the movies, the guy there with his pen and the folded thing. Today we did this and so hurt himself. And I took that home because I hadn't finished the day before and I was doing that on the plane. And Shelley, the co-director, she had the notebook that tied together everybody else's notebooks. She did the overall drawings and the overall measurements of the whole site and where our datum points were, where we measured things from, along the ship. That was all in her notebook. She had left everything back at the lab, and this is one of those, oh my God, really, that happened to you? She put all her personal gear, including her weather gear and stuff, in two boxes up against the wall in the lab. Friday, after we left, people ran the lab, cleaned the lab up, and they put the trash over there, and they told the trash people, take everything that's against the wall. And so her notebook was destroyed. All of those overall drawings and the things that tied everything together. And Monday we got back after the initial shock of finding that notebook had been destroyed and some drawings and things. I thought, well, it's not the end of the world. Remember, I was a physics major, so I had a lot of math. I could do calculus, advanced calculus in four-dimensional spherical coordinates. I could do incredible trigonometry. No problem, I'll work this backwards. Sounds reasonable. And we had personal computers by then, so that would make it even better. So we got home and started working on the preservation, which you clean the wood and then you go through some chemical processes and impregnate it with a microcrystalline wax. It takes years. Started working on that. Started doing historical research, trying to figure out what ship this was. Trying to put back together the site. And the problem was, it didn't work. It was as if our datum points, those initial points that we measured from, the big spikes I had driven into the concrete in New York, it was as if they were moving in three dimensions. Not just on a day-to-day basis, but almost on an hourly basis. Not a lot, a foot in one direction and 3 inches in the other direction. We were working by way in feet and inches because I assumed the ship was built in feet and inches as opposed to the metric system at that time period, and it being British. And so everything was in feet and inches. And it just wasn't working. And I had mathematicians check it out. Everything I was doing was right, but it just wasn't working. So I get fed up with that every once in a while, throw it on the shelf and go back to doing historical research. There had been a study of the site first, before the archaeologists went in. Amy Friedland, a really good historian, had gone in and checked out all the archives in New York to find a history, and she hadn't seen anything in there about a ship being buried. So off I went looking for any kind of information about ships that went into New York and didn't leave, who were about the right size and about the right time. I wasn't sure that area was filled, we know, in the 1740s and 50s, just from looking at maps, if nothing else. And I could narrow it down to a few ships, but that was about it. To make a very long story short, eventually I was able to figure out the general shape of the ship pretty quickly, and it was interesting because it wasn't a typical British ship that we knew. Unfortunately, all we knew were the warships. And you say, really? You could see merchant ships in illustrations, paintings, and they're all, even on a large painting, there may be an inch or two long, off in the distance. The warships, we got all kinds of designs for them. You can buy books that have, design of 90 warships from that time period. We have a treatise from the 1680s on how the best Navy warship designer, how he designed ships. He wrote a treatise on that. And again, 100 years later, in the 1780s, you have a fellow named Chapman who wrote on how he did it. The fellow in the 1680s used geometry. And basically what he had done was he had a ship that worked really well, and he went and measured it and figured everything as a fraction of the maximum breadth of the ship. So he took the widest part of the ship, and he said, okay. So Anthony Dean took these measurements, and he came up with fractions. Well, his fractions are really strange. He was taking 11/64 of the maximum breadth of the ship to make an arc this way, and then the length is all these weird fractions to come up with a perfect ship, and then he could copy that, he could scale that up or down as he pleased. It worked. Chapman, in the 1780s, on his treatise, he's using advanced math. He's figuring the metacenters and the, weight changes and all kinds of things, pre-calculus. But we didn't know anything about warships in between, and we didn't know anything about merchant ships. Nobody wrote it down. And you might think, why? Well, the warships are government ships. So one, they had to record everything. They had to get all those designs checked, and the Admiralty had to approve them. And then they were the federal government, so they have archives. The Navy had archives, and they kept things in nice stone buildings. The merchants didn't have to have anything on paper. It could be done with a handshake. Hey, can you build me a 100-ton ship that goes to the West Indies and back to Dover, New Hampshire? Yeah, you go to somebody who does it well, and he builds you a ship. He worked out a price, and you handshake, maybe a one-page contract, and that was it. He didn't have to show you his secret design. It wasn't necessary. And it was secret, because being a shipwright was extremely important in those days. Not only was it good money, but you were, in the colonies at least, you were not only exempt from military duty, it was illegal for you to be in the military. You were too precious a commodity. And so, one, Good job, too. You weren't going to get scalped when you went to fight the Indians up in the mountains. And so they kept their secrets, and we don't know them. We didn't know them. And so I was out to find them. I was working on the ship, trying to figure out the final design. Well, we start with wood that's sort of displayed out, right? And then we try to put it all back together. And one of the best ways, it really, is to make a model of each piece, a scale model of each piece, and see how it fits together. Now, yes, it can fit together a number of ways, but that's a good way to approximate it. And to get by the fact that my written data, the mapping, wasn't working. I was having trouble with that. And then in a phone call to one of the guys who was working on part of this with me, we were talking, he said, well, Warren, remember when we were taking the bow apart that last night? Yep. And it was literally freezing rain. The rain was coming down and freezing on us. And we had floodlights. We worked right through the last two nights, you know, 24 hours a day. We were about 20 feet down from street level, and the mud wall started slumping in on us. And I said, everybody out of the pool, that's it, you know. So we had planned to get 25 feet of the bow. We only got 18 feet of the bow because it was just too dangerous. I said, yeah. He said, those last measurements that tied the bow and the next section together were taken just before that. Right. So there's a good chance that the wall had slumped in already before those measurements were taken. You just didn't see it because it was dark and freezing rain. I said, oh, you're right. You're right, Jay. I'll go check that out. So I checked that out. And then I was walking along, taking a break, which is, you know, some people get their epiphanies when they're running. I don't run. But when I'm walking, and it occurred to me, what if the whole ship was doing this? You know, we were going down. The lowest part of our ship was 23 feet below street level. We're letting the water in every night, and every day we'd pump the water out and dig a little farther down. Then we'd let the water come in, and we'd pump the water out and we'd dig a little farther down. This was solid oak walls, but maybe they were coming in a little bit each day. And that's why I was getting these floating numbers. So I went back, and I said, okay, now let's make believe that these benchmarks didn't move, which they shouldn't have moved, and that the ship is moving, and I could graph you, I could show you just what parts of the ship breathed and which didn't during the day because of different supports, and that had been my problem all along, why I couldn't put it all together. Once I figured that out, I could figure out exactly the dimensions of the ship, everything about it. Then I took it one step farther, and there are very few people who do this sort of thing, obviously. And there are maybe five or six of us in the world who take it one step farther backwards and say, okay, but then how did the guy design it? Not just what was the design or how it was built. Because for one thing, if a guy has a design, or a woman now, has a design for a ship, if you're working with wood, it's different than working with steel or fiberglass because there are imperfections in the wood. You might be about to drill a hole to make a fastening, but there's a giant knot there. And we're talking heavy oak timbers, 9 by 9 inches, covered by 2 inch on either side of planking. And what if there's a knot somewhere where you want to make a fastening? Then you've got to make adjustments in your ship. Or you don't curve the wood. It's not like building a boat where you heat up and curve the wood. You had to get wood that was already naturally curved for every curved piece you needed in the ship. You could curve the wood, the heavy timbers, but you'd be breaking the fibers once you get beyond about 4 inches, because the fibers are only so strong. So the outer fibers would rip and you'd lose the strength. So you had to find ships. You go to trees where the bow is coming off at an angle, or the roots are going off at another angle, and the shipwright would go out and buy trees that would fit and then carve out the curved wood. Okay, so you get it back to your ship and you're going to build the ship and you don't have the right curve. So what do? Well, you make adjustments because you're brilliant. You're one of the highest technological people in the community and you figure this out. And so your design, your finished ship is different than your design. Okay, so I had to figure out what the design was and then how he did it. Where did he put his compass? Why did he do this fraction instead of that? And so I worked for years on that and eventually figured out, and it was amazingly simple. It was a technique we just didn't know before. He used very simple geometry. He used You got to think back a little before computers when we were all young and in the Stone Age. We didn't think so much in tens then. We thought in 12s, dozens, because you can make lots of fractions with 12. This guy did it with 24, which you can make even more fractions. He had a maximum breadth of the ship was exactly 24 feet. All the arcs that he used, very simple arcs, pieces of circles and straight lines, they're all fractions of 24 feet. So there are 4 foot, 8 foot, 16 foot lengths all through this ship. All the radii of all these complex curves he made, there'll be, you know, a 12 foot diameter going one way and then a reverse of 4 feet going the other way. And he worked them tangent to each other so that the circles met and then met the straight lines perfectly. It took me a long time to figure this out. But when I was done and then the proof was in the pudding, it matched the models that we had made earlier. So we've discovered a new technique, or the old technique, and why it was so easy to keep secret. They didn't have to write this down. If this was a technique that other merchant shipwrights used, very simple to memorize. Even I, with a poor memory, could have done that. Does it answer the question about the British Empire? Well, I think it does. Because the ship, as designed, was a combination, quite sure, of a Dutch, the Dutch called them flouts, the English called the same thing a flyboat. And it was basically, think of a big rectangle going through the ocean, kind of like a container going through a container box, going through the ocean, only you round off the very bow, and then you round off the stern. And that was their hull design. Very flat bottom, nice square sides going right down the hull, not changing at all in the whole midsection, so it's no water resistant there. It's a ship that you can put a very simple sailing rig on, so you have a smaller crew. Smaller crew is not only less money to pay them, less food on board, less water on board, so you can have more cargo on board. So your crew to tonnage ratio goes down, costs are down. Trouble with the flyboat, you couldn't sail it fast, and you couldn't sail it in really rough weather. You never want to cross the Atlantic in one of those flyboats. They used them in the Baltic and stuff. But the British had captured a lot of them in the war that ended in 1713. And the British merchant ships were not very efficient. They were built like their warships before that. They were sharp-bowed below the water. Above the water, they were bluff. And the stern was like a modern yacht with that long deadwood in the water where the hole in the water that the hull creates closes beautifully behind it with hardly a ripple. And they could sail fast and they could go right through the hurricanes and come out the other end, believe it or not. And this guy, or the people that developed this technique just before him, put the two together. So this ship had that typical British bow and that typical British stern, which was so good. And then in between, it was built just like a Dutch flyboat, exactly. You could put one over the other, they look exactly the same. Flat bottom, nice simple curves and straight sides going down the middle. I had a fellow, naval architect, plug this in modern technology, using computers to figure out how good a ship this was. And he said it was a fantastic ship for just that purpose. With a typical wind crossing the Atlantic, it would only heel over about 3 degrees. And if a storm came, you had plenty of time to pick up your sails. Remember, in those days, if you saw a storm coming, you had to have enough men to pick up all that canvas. The sails were raised. Nowadays, you have a sail that you just drop, you know, and so one person can drop a schooner's sail in plenty of time for the storm. In those days, you had to pick it up. So you could sail this with a limited crew compared to the other ships. So we had a much more efficient ship. We found one. Is this the answer? Well, with that design technique was that simple and that good, then we've got possibly the answer. We don't know. One of the things that would support this being not just an anomaly, not just a one-of-a-kind ship, also was that the ship was very successful. Once I figured out what ship it was, I followed its history, and it was working the Atlantic for about 13 years, which is about 5 years more than average for a merchant ship at that time. And so it was a successful ship, obviously. And so it was a successful design. So what have we learned? Maybe one of the factors that helped the British Empire grow, learned about their design technology. What were the people, the shipwrights doing with the merchant ships versus the warships, a simpler technology, but one that, in the design, but one that worked very well. So that all ties into that. And our time is just about up, and so I would open this for questions. Mom, moderator, thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Reese. This is the summer, Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. Let me begin by asking this. You didn't start out as an archaeologist. You started out as a kid with an interest in small engine repair. How did this get you into archaeology?
Yeah, that's a good question. When I was an undergraduate, I had, yes, that's right. As even in my high school days, I would take apart the lawnmower and fix it myself. And when I had a motorcycle in college, I took that all apart and changed the bearings and the rings and all those things. I was just into that. And when I was an undergraduate, I took up some scuba diving, and I read an article in National Geographic about these archaeologists working in the Aegean on an old Roman wine ship. And I was fascinated by the technology, what an engineer would call the elegant technology that they had designed. Very simple things that worked underwater. And if you work near the salt water at all, you know salt water hates technology, and it'll eat at your electronics, at your mechanical things. Everything can go wrong. And yet these archaeologists had worked these things out pretty cool. So I went to see them just to find out more about how they did that, how their minds worked to develop these things that were so simple that worked. And they needed a mechanic for the next summer in Turkey. And I said, I can do that. And so I went with them. Turned out I was going to be their assistant photographer also. The photographer didn't show up because of marital problems. So I ended up getting trained to be their photographer for their National Geographic articles that summer and fixing machines. But I became fascinated with what these archaeologists and historians were doing, not so much the archaeology, but how they were able to, these people were pretty high up on the scale, and how they were able to bring in information that people knew from other archaeological digs, that people knew from reading old tablets, and putting it all together with what we were finding right there, and saying, oh, you know, this supports so-and-so's theory, or this changes what we thought about that, right there on the spot that evening, over dinner. And I thought, wow, this is really cool. This is well beyond what I had ever envisioned doing. And then slowly over the next 4 or 5 years, I was a chemical oceanography technician for a while, and that's when we met, and decided to go back to school and become one. I had to learn how to spell archaeology.
Thank you. Yeah. Question from our audience. Your previous study involved a vessel at Boone Island off the southern coast of Maine. Please give a short summary of what you found there. And then it says, not described by Kenneth Roberts.
Not described by Kenneth Roberts. Okay. How many of you know anything about Boone Island so I know what my audience is? Not many. Just a few. Okay. 1710, a British merchant ship, English merchant ship called Nottingham Galley, wrecked there in the middle of the night, well, 9 o'clock at night, in the middle of a storm. If Boone Island is off of York, Maine, it's about 7 miles out to sea. It is nothing but a jumble of rocks. There's not a blade of grass that grows on Boone Island. Now there's a lighthouse. There wasn't one then. And it just gets washed over but in the middle of a storm. Not a kind of place you want to have a shipwreck because you're out of sight of the people on the mainland. Well, they wrecked there in mid-December, and they were on the island. The crew was on that island for almost a month. And so it's mid-December to about mid-January off the coast of Maine. They never got a fire going. They ate mussels raw. They grabbed a gull, ate it raw. And when the carpenter died, they ate him raw. And eventually they were saved. Okay. What did we learn? Unfortunately for us, just underwater, it's all rock. There's no sediment there to protect any artifacts, any part of the ship, from the storms that go. So it's a jumble of rocks on the top of a ledge, on top of another ledge. Through the years, we knew there was some cannon down there. The state of Maine is even poorer than the state of New Hampshire, believe it or not. And so everybody just left things there until some people from Massachusetts decided they wanted to steal the cannon. So I got a call from the state saying, can you go save the, you know, so we went down there. All we found were 9 cannon. They had taken one and some shot, some grenades, some lead shot, no ceramics or glass, all wiped out by storms, just carrying everything away. So what did we learn? We learned that those cannon were made in Sweden. They weren't British cannon at all. So Sweden made the enemy of England's cannon. And 3 of them were loaded with powder but not shot. And we don't know exactly why. So that's about where things are. And that's another one of those projects that as I got one more year teaching, and then I've got some research to do on that to take that farther.
Thank you. I'm going to put these two questions together because I've read the book and I know the answers. Everyone else should read the book. So did you find out the name of the actual ship, and do you have any idea where the ship was built?
Yes. And yes, you'll have to read the book. No. yes, we found out the name of the ship. I'm quite sure. All the evidence points to it being... Should I tell the title or make them read the book? I'll tell you the title. It's Princess Carolina, which is a lovely name. Built by Benjamin Austin in Charleston, South Carolina, in 1717. And there's a number of things that tie that together, which I didn't have time to get into today. It took a lot of study to both historical research, the archaeology, zoology from one of Brian's actually former mentors, Ruth Turner down at Harvard, who figured out what kind of shipworms were in the wood, and that was a big clue to us. And also botany of the wood, because even though we're looking at the wood and it kind of looked like the southern live oak, we sent samples at the time to 3 best labs in the country, wood labs, and they were not able to really pin down the exact species of the wood because it was so degraded. And it wasn't until just a few years ago that we were able, with scanning electron microscope, there's one scientist who was able to say, yes, this absolutely is live oak. And that all of those things coming together, there could only be one ship that fit.
Another question from the floor. These ships were square rigged, lifting canvas?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Were
they used as slave ships?
Some were. This ship almost definitely wasn't. And you say, how can you say that? Especially since it was built in Charleston and owned by Charleston people for the first couple years. There are records, they're port records, and they would have listed... Now, could they have carried a slave? Could someone have gotten on board with their slave? Yes, but not in trade. Those would have been recorded in those records, and the 2 voyages it made to Charleston, they were from London, not as if you move slaves that way, and they would have been recorded, and they're not. After that, the ship's primary owner is an agent in London who was against the trade slave, even in those early days, the early 1700s, and none of his ships were allowed to carry on any part of the slave trade, period. And again, in the limited records I have of that ship, you don't see it. And this fellow was very adamant that his ships would not carry any slave trade. Could they have carried a slave as a passenger? Possibly.
And when will this be on Nova?
The visuals actually, in part of the recording, since we had almost unlimited money from an archaeologist's point of view, we hired a crew, Sam Lowe, who actually did a lot of Nova series for, what's the Boston station?
WBUR?
Yeah, those
WGBH,
people. WGBH. He did the series for Nova, the anthropology series years ago, and I knew him from working with him in Turkey. He came with a crew, and they shot 1,800 feet, I think, of 16-millimeter film and the sound. Now, to give you an idea of the quality, the guy on the camera had an Oscar for doing documentaries, and the sound man had his own Oscar, so we're pretty well covered. We've got really nice footage, but nobody's done anything with it.
In the book, you have a lot of information about the owners and the captains of the ship. What's the process that you use to find that kind of information?
To find out The historical research is long and complex. It started with Amy Friedlander's work on she had studied the landowners on the lots. If you look at the block that's just inland from this block, there were a number of commercial lots, businesses downstairs, and then the two upper stairs of people will be living there. And those people each were given a license by the city of New York to extend their land out one block. So you fill that land, it's yours. Head out to a deep water, and you have to put it in a street and stuff. They had to have worked together to put this ship in, because the ship goes right across eight lots. But there's nothing in any of the three out of their 12 records still exist, and not a mention of a ship. And none of them owned a ship this size. So then I started studying the shipwrecks at the same time, started studying the ships coming and going from the different ports. The British Empire was trying to keep everybody within the empire, trading within the empire, not outside the empire. So they would follow where the ships went. There was a clerk in each port throughout the empire, and they recorded who was coming and going and what they were carrying and when they were built and how, you know, who built them and who owned them and how many men on board and how many cannon on board, so they could identify each ship carefully. And then every quarter of the year they would send these reports to London, and clerks there would trace out each ship to make sure they were staying within the empire. Some of those records, not all of them, still exist in London and various other places. So did a lot of that, trying to find ships of the right size and shape that were coming and going, and that helped me narrow things down. Also, spent time in the archives at the Historical Society and the State Archives in Charleston, in Virginia, because the ship went in and out of Virginia, carrying tobacco, New York, Public Record Office, which is now the National Archives in London. Been to Lisbon. We were talking about Lisbon earlier, because the ship also stopped in Madeira, lucky ship, to grab wine on the way back to the colonies. So just touching the iceberg there. The other thing we did is I started reading newspapers from that time period, looking for ships coming and going, seeing if we could find, because as I said, a lot of the port records are missing. We have decades where there are no port records for anything, because the Brits, they ran out of space over there in their archives. So what do they do? And nobody's looked at these for a few years, burn them, and put in new things. And so I was looking through old newspapers, and those are sketchy. There's a four-pager from New York and, you know, something from Boston and Philly, trying to tie everything together, look through genealogies. I could go on for about 2 hours, but that's the basics of it, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Now, our last question. Have you done historic research on archaeological sites involving Native American artifacts? A big project by Kinder Morgan is bringing natural gas through our region, which has been inhabited by Native Americans.
Yes, I have, but only very little, only when I was a student. On the other hand, not only Native American, but European American historic sites have to be considered when any of this happens. I imagine there are federal and state permits necessary. And they require both historical and archaeological research. So typically, if there's an area where there have been Native Americans, the contractors or the permittees have to hire professional, certified, we call them prehistoric archaeologists, even though they're not that old, to go in, and historic archaeologists to go in and to check things out. And typically with prehistoric, they're, you know, they don't have cellar holes there, so they'll do sampling, and they're very good. We've done a couple of things where we go jointly together, and they'll just look over an area and look at their contour maps and say, I bet there was a summer place here. I bet there was a village over there. And they're usually spot on, because, you know, they get a feel for where people wanted to live. So they'll check those out. And if they find anything at all, those laws require that funds are there and time for them to do a proper archaeological investigation. So if that pipeline is going to go right through here and they say, wow, that's that old 20th century church or however old this was, they'll have to do a careful excavation, just like they did for this site that I was talking about in New York. So it slows things down, and it costs money, but it's a money-wise, it's a drop in the bucket. It's not even a drop in the bucket.
So it's not going to stop it?
Not going to stop it. It's going to, you know, and they can go around things, too, if they really, it's expensive to go around, but they'll go around. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you again, Warren, for sharing. For sharing your time and expertise with us today. You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org. The program next Sunday will feature Daniel Weeks. His speech will be entitled Poor in Democracy: How America is Defaulting on Democracy and the Long Walk to Get It Back. Thank you, Dr. Rees, for a wonderful talk. Now, please join us for more time with our presenter and for some refreshments in the parish hall. These refreshments have been most generally provided by Joe's at the Grove. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank RBC Wealth Management for providing the lovely flowers for today's talk. And I'd also like to thank David Fleming, who did the sound editing for us today.